Pitt sat down, trying desperately to put the pieces together. It seems fantastic that Dr. Egan created a revolutionary dynamic engine in almost the same time span that he designed a working teleporter.
The man was a genius, said Max. No doubt about it. What makes him even more extraordinary is that he did it without an army of assistants or a huge government-sponsored laboratory.
That's true, Pitt agreed. He did it alone in a hidden lab, the location of which we've yet to ferret out. Pitt stopped by his office to clear his desk, read his mail, and answer voice messages. While he was working, his phone rang.
You were on the right track, my boy, boomed St. Julian Perlmutter. Captain Nemo truly existed, except his true name was Cameron Amherst. He was a captain in the Royal Navy.
Not the Dakar Indian Prince?
No, replied Perlmutter. Verne met Amherst on a voyage across the Atlantic on the passenger liner Great Eastern. Amherst regaled him with stories of his desire to build a vessel capable of going anywhere beneath the oceans. He drew designs on Verne's notebook paper and described in detail the revolutionary propulsion system he had devised to power his submarine. Needless to say, Verne was enthralled. He kept up heavy correspondence with Amherst for 4 years. Then, suddenly, the letters stopped coming. Verne went on to write imaginative tales and became famous, and put Amherst from his mind. Verne owned several yachts which he sailed around Europe. It was on one of these voyages, off Denmark, that a great whale-like vessel rose out of the sea and drifted alongside Verne's sailboat. Verne, along with his son Michel, who'd accompanied him, watched as Captain Amherst rose from a forward hatch tower and hailed him, inviting the writer to come aboard. Leaving his boat in Michel's command, Verne went aboard Amherst's astounding underwater vessel.
So the Nautilus did exist. On his end of the phone, Perlmutter nodded almost reverently.
Verne learned that Amherst had secretly built his submarine in a great underwater cavern beneath the cliffs under his family estate in Scotland. When the vessel was completed, he put together a professional crew and sailed the seas for 30 years.
How long was Verne on board? Asked Pitt.
He stayed on board the Nautilus, which was the actual name given the sub by Amherst, for nearly 2 weeks. It was more than ample time for Verne to study every inch of the vessel, which he exactingly recorded in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
What finally happened to Amherst? Pitt asked.
According to an account in Verne's notebook, a mysterious messenger came to his house in 1895 and gave him a letter from Amherst. Most of the captain's crew had died, and he had intended to return to his ancestral home in Scotland, but it had been destroyed in a fire that killed his remaining relatives. In addition, the cavern where he had built the Nautilus had suffered a cave-in, so there wasn't even that to return to.
So he sailed to the mysterious island?
No, stated Perlmutter. Verne made that up. So the final resting place of Amherst and his Nautilus would not be found. Not, at least, for a long, long time. The letter went on to say that Amherst had found a similar underwater cavern on the Hudson River in New York, which would serve as the tomb for him and the Nautilus.
Pitt stiffened, unable to suppress a shout of euphoria. The Hudson River?
That's what was written in the notebook.
St. Julian?
Yes. I love you to death.
The early morning mist hung poised over the blue water of the river, just as it had nearly 1,000 years ago when the Vikings arrived. Visibility was less than 100 yards, and the fleet of small sailing yachts and powerboats that usually crowded the river on summer Sundays had yet to leave their docks. The speed of the 26-foot Numa boat was kept to a meticulous 4 knots as it dragged the long, narrow yellow sensor below the water in its wake. Signals from the sensor were sent into the recording unit on the side-scan sonar, and Giardino stood and stared intently at the colored three-dimensional display that revealed the bottom of the river and the submerged rock at the base of the palisades. There was no beach, only sand and rock that quickly dropped off once it reached the water. Kelly stood at the helm, steering cautiously and keeping her eyes darting between the shoreline to her left and the waters ahead, wary of any underwater rocks that might carve up the bottom of the boat. "Another 200 yards before we pass beneath Dad's farm," she announced. "Any readings, Al?" Pitt asked through the windshield that was propped open.
"Rocks and silt," Giardino answered briefly. "Silt and rocks."
"Keep an eye out for any indication of a rock slide." 100 yards, warned Kelly. Pitt aimed his binoculars at the top of the cliff 350 feet above and saw the roofs of Egan's house and study rising over the edge. He leaned forward in anticipation and carefully studied the face of the palisade. "I have something," he said almost casually. Giardino looked up.
"Like what?"
"I have what looks like man-made markings in the rock. Let's pull in the sensor and anchor the boat just offshore."
"You think we should dive before finding a target?" asked Giardino.
Pitt leaned back and stared up the steep palisade. "We're directly below Dr. Egan's study. If there's a hidden cavern, it has to be around here. We'll have an easier time sighting it beneath the surface by eye."
"May I come too?" Kelly asked. "I got my certification in the Bahamas."
"Let us go first. If we find something, I'll surface and wave you in."